Welcome and thank you for joining us for another episode of KPMG's Inside International Tax, a podcast devoted to recent developments, observations, and trends related to U.S. international tax. I'm one of your hosts, Gary Scanlon, a principal in KPMG's WNT International Tax Practice. I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Kristen Gamboa, a managing director in the same group. Hey, Kristen.
Hey, Gary.
For today's episode, we're recording in Lake House, KPMG's beautiful training facility in Orlando, Florida. We're excited to be here. It's far from the cold of DC. Kristen actually lives in Orlando, and for her, it's frigid.
It's very cold.
What is it, 60 degrees, 55? Yeah. The kids may not go to school for a couple weeks, but from DC, my perspective, it's really nice. So today, we're going to be talking about Section 892 and sovereign wealth funds, foreign government funds, and investment in the U.S., an interesting topic. So sovereign wealth funds and foreign government pension funds are an important and growing source of investment in the U.S. The rules under Section 892 have played a major part in shaping how sovereigns engage with U.S. markets, shaping both capital allocation and fund structuring. 892 provides a U.S. tax exemption for certain investment income earned by foreign governments, and it reflects a long-standing balance, facilitating sovereign investment in the U.S. while ensuring that income connected to commercial activities remains subject to U.S. tax and thus doesn't give sovereigns a competitive advantage over other U.S. businesses. As sovereign wealth funds, public pensions, and state-owned entities have become more active and sophisticated market participants, the practical application of 892 has taken on new dimensions, and with it, a growing set of considerations for asset managers navigating onboarding, diligence, governance rights, and compliance expectations. It's so important that even the Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, recently tweeted or X'd or whatever it is, about 892, vowing to, quote, preserve established market practices and continue to support current and future sovereign wealth fund investment in the United States as we drive economic growth for the benefit of all Americans. When a cabinet official refers to an actual code section, you know it's important. So in this episode, we'll focus on the broader framework and practical implications of Section 892. We'll also touch on the recent regulatory developments, including how final and proposed Section 892 regs issued at the end of last year fit into the bigger picture of sovereign wealth funds and where it may signal evolving expectations for investors and asset managers alike. For our discussion today, we're joined by a friend of the podcast, Dan Winnick, a principal in KPMG's WNT International Tax Practice. Welcome back, Dan.
Thanks for having us.
It's cold in New York, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I'm glad to be here with you in Orlando.
You wouldn't usually be glad to be with me, but you are now. We're also joined by a new guest, Kirsten Gallagher, a principal in KPMG's International Tax Financial Services Group and U.S. Tax Leader for sovereign wealth and pension funds. Well, that sounds important. Welcome to the podcast, Kirsten.
Thanks for having me. To set the stage for our listeners who may not be as familiar with this topic, Kirsten, can you tell us what makes the U.S. an attractive destination for sovereign investors?
Sure. So there are a number of different sovereign investors around the world, and they each have different mandates. So some of them are designed to invest in their home countries, and then the U.S. wouldn't really be relevant to them. But there are many others that are either designed to spread risk out economically by foreign investment or just seeking the best investments that they can find commercially, no matter where they can be located. With those differences, I would say that as a class, sovereign investors tend to be long-term, stable sources of capital. They don't like to take uncompensated investment risks. And if you think about that profile, it makes the U.S. a really attractive destination for them in general. There are kind of numbers to back this up. So according to Global SWF, and this is consistent with what I've seen from our clients here, the U.S. was a target of 47% of sovereign investing last year globally. And that was with a year where we were facing the potential retaliatory tax that made them less likely to invest in the U.S. than they probably otherwise would have been. Sovereigns and foreign pensions are heavy investors in the U.S. in public equities, public credit, but they're also really invested in private equity, real estate, infrastructure, private credit. They invest together with fund sponsors, but they also invest directly on their own. And if you think about the fact that reportedly sovereign and pension fund capital is over $25 trillion, the United States as an investment destination and these foreign investors as a source of capital have a really important relationship.
Thanks. So what are the tax considerations for sovereign investors investing in the U.S.? What role does Section 892 play in these considerations?
So like they have different investment profiles, the sovereign investors also have different tax profiles. At a basic level, the U.S. will treat sovereign investors in foreign pension funds like any other U.S. inbound investor that's a corporation. So they are subject to U.S. tax if they have a U.S. trade or business. If they are from a country with a tax treaty, they can be eligible for tax treaty benefits. Where they're investing in U.S. real estate, they can be subject to FIRPTA tax, just like any other inbound investor. Section 892 is a really key exception to that standard treatment, though, especially for the sovereign wealth funds that are not from treaty countries, which is around $10 trillion in capital, according to Global SWF. So there are a lot of people really relying on Section 892. Without a treaty, those investors tend to face effective tax rates for the U.S. investments well over 45%. So it's not an attractive way or place for them to invest unless all of their U.S. source income is really just capital gains from sales of stock, a REIT investment in certain circumstances, or portfolio interest on debt investments, things like treasury. Where they can qualify for Section 892, though, the sovereign wealth and foreign pension funds can benefit from exemption on all of their U.S. dividends, their U.S. interest income, and capital gains on the sales of the real estate-rich corporations, so no FIRPTA on share sales. And that allows them to be much more competitive sources of capital. This means that historically, sovereign investors have tried to ensure that all of their U.S. investments qualify for Section 892 where they can.
So it sounds like Section 892 is a really important provision for certain investments. What kind of restrictions come with 892 and who is it not available to?
So Section 892 is not available with respect to what's called commercial activities, and it's not available to something called a controlled commercial entity. So commercial activities is a standard that's unique to Section 892. It doesn't appear in other sections of the code, but it's similar to concepts like trade or business or unrelated business taxable income that do show up in other provisions of the code. The proposed regulations that just came out provide a little bit more detail about some differences between commercial activities and trade or business. Section 892 applies to foreign governments, whether an integral part of a foreign government or a what's called a controlled entity of a foreign government, which is generally a wholly owned subsidiary of a foreign government organized in that same country. Now, both integral parts and controlled entities can only qualify for Section 892 from income that is not attributable to commercial activities. But a controlled entity must not be engaged in commercial activities anywhere in the world, or it does not qualify for the Section 892 benefit because it's what's called a controlled commercial entity. So one of the main things that Section 892 investors think about with respect to their controlled entities is making sure that they're not engaged in commercial activities anywhere in the world.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, interesting point, a scary point, that if you have a single footfall, potentially lose the 892 exemption on all your income. And so that's huge.
And this plays a big part in how foreign sovereigns structure their investment, both in the United States, but also around the world, because a foreign sovereign can own both controlled entities that seek the 892 exemption and controlled commercial entities, and knowing which they're dealing with for a particular investment is a very important structuring consideration when they're going into a deal.
So Dan, sounds like there are quite a few restrictions. And how did the final and proposed regs released in December inform on these restrictions or modify them?
So in December of 2025, final and proposed regulations were released under Section 892. The final regulations finalized package was mostly proposed in 2011 with some modifications in 2022. They also finalized some regulations that have actually been outstanding since 1988. So this is a long-awaited reg package by Section 892 investors. And largely, the final regulations finalized the proposed regulations as they were proposed. But there were a couple of key points in the final regulations that are worth highlighting. First, one aspect of the final regulations was what was called the qualified partnership interest exception. The 2011 proposed regulations contained an exception for limited partnerships, and this was really relevant for controlled entity investors. The limited partnership exception would prevent a controlled entity from being treated as a controlled commercial entity if all of its commercial activities income was derived exclusively through a limited partnership investment. There had been an earlier exception for publicly traded partnerships, but this expanded it more broadly to limited partnership interests where there was both limitation in liability and limitation in control. The final regulations finalized that exception, but changed the name to qualified partnership interest, in part to take account that many entities taxable as partnerships are organized as limited liability companies or under foreign law. And so limited partnership interest was not really descriptive of the kind of interest that they were taking into account. But there were a couple of changes that went direct to final in the regulations. They never were in proposed form. One of them is that the limited partnership exception did not contain any limitation on how much of the partnership you could own. But to be a qualified partnership interest, you can't be in economic control, meaning you can't own more than 50% of the partnership. They also create a safe harbor that's helpful for investors that own less than 5% of a limited partnership, and generally say that you qualify so long as you have both limitation and liability and aren't actively involved in management of the partnership. The second key point in the final regulations was the exception for inadvertent commercial activities. So we talked about earlier how a small business, say a hot dog stand, will taint a controlled entity's access to Section 892 for its investments all around the world. If that commercial activity was inadvertent, is a result, and the Section 892 investor had written policies and procedures in place to prevent commercial activities, and it cures within 180 days of discovering those commercial activities, the inadvertence exception prevents the controlled entity from being treated as a controlled commercial entity. So this is an important backstop for Section 892 investors, but it does require written policies and procedures. In December, Treasury and the IRS also released proposed regulations. These proposed regulations deal with new topics rather than finalizing earlier proposals. There are two elements of the proposed regulations worth highlighting. One dealt with loan investments, and another dealt with what it means to be in effective control of an investment. And that's especially relevant where you don't have 50% ownership, but you might have control by other means.
I think we'll talk a little bit more about those later. Dan, thank you. So many sovereign wealth investors invest in the U.S. through investment funds. What do sponsors and managers of these funds need to know about the regulations, and how do they implicate the work that they do for sovereign wealth funds?
Investment funds with sovereign wealth investors will need to take these restrictions into account. So investment funds with sovereign wealth investors have generally made side letter covenants that promise to use commercially best efforts to avoid attributing commercial activities to their investors. This is because of the potential existential nature of commercial activities for the 892 exemption, not just for this one investment, but for all their investments. In addition to those side letter covenants, investors may be looking for their managers to have written policies and procedures in place to preserve the inadvertence exception if any commercial activity is conducted at the partnership level. On the other hand, the final regulations by finalizing the qualified partnership interest exception, may make investors a lot more willing to rely on that exception to prevent commercial activities from being attributed to the partner. And so it may limit the scope of some Section 892 compliance discussions where it's clear that we're dealing with a qualified partnership interest. All that said, the qualified partnership interest exception doesn't prevent tax from being imposed. If a fund is invested in the United States, investors will still be concerned about the risk of deriving effectively connected income and potentially having a filing requirement in the U.S., even if their Section 892 status isn't threatened. So the same issues that have always been relevant between funds and their sovereign wealth investors will continue to be relevant.
Yeah, it sounds like there are still complexities in navigating the 892 exemption, particularly for asset managers. Are there alternative structuring options for these asset managers to employ to achieve a similar result to that under 892?
So it's important to remember that foreign investors benefit from a number of exemptions and reductions in tax besides Section 892, and it's often possible to structure investments so that Section 892 isn't the basis for exemption for a particular investment. For example, foreign investments don't need Section 892. Investments in loans often qualify for the portfolio interest exemption, and many investors qualify under treaties. So thinking at the outset when Section 892 is needed so that the Section 892 investor needs to be unblocked all the way from the asset level is an important structuring consideration.
And just to add to that, before we had these new final regulations, there were some Section 892 investors that thought that the rules might work differently. So some of them thought that you couldn't have a pocket of investments that relied on Section 892 and then a separate set of controlled commercial entities that didn't rely on Section 892. And they believed that the government might think that to qualify for Section 892 somewhere, all of your investments had to qualify for Section 892. So one really helpful fact for asset managers is that it's clear in the final regulations that that isn't the way the rules work, and you can have separate chains of entities as long as you keep them separate and don't commingle between the commercial and non-commercial chains, and that makes structuring a lot more flexible.
So thanks. I want to shift to discussing growing areas in the market, and in particular, investments in private credit. Investments in the form of private credit, such as loans, is seemingly a growing area for investors. The proposed regulations address when a loan investment is a commercial activity. Kirsten, how do the proposed regulations impact the private credit market?
So you're absolutely right, Kristen, that this is a really growing area of investment for these foreign government entities. According to the Financial Times, for 2024 and 2025, a quarter of the private credit market was held by these investors. And so it is crucially important for them that they understand how the rules work for Section 892, because while in many cases they can rely on a treaty or they could rely on portfolio interest exception, oftentimes they have been relying on Section 892 for these investments. The proposed regulations have actually come out quite differently from how the market thought that Section 892 applied to credit investing. Under the former proposed regulations, there was reference to investments in credit being exempt under Section 892 unless they were entered into by a banking, financing, or similar business. And so there was a thought in the market that standards for ECI were quite similar to standards for 892, and people who were relying on 892 tended to follow guidelines very similar to what they were following if they were trying to avoid having a U.S. trader business from their credit investments. The proposed regulations take a different tack. So the proposed regulations say, in general, acquiring a loan is a commercial activity. They provide two safe harbors where you can be comfortable that acquiring a loan isn't a commercial activity. One is for an investment in credit in an SEC-registered offering, which is very limited. It's helpful, but that is not most of what these investors are doing. The second is for a secondary offering of debt, but only on an established market. So again, that's helpful where that's what you're doing, But these investors are very active in private secondary deals, things that are not on established markets, and had been previously very comfortable that that was not commercial activity and they could rely on their Section 892 exemption. These proposed regulations have had a significant business impact, and the 892 investors and the asset managers are very concerned that the government is viewing these credit investments more strictly than was expected, and that that could cause a lot of turmoil in the private credit markets. So people, I think, did take a lot of comfort from Secretary Bessent's statement that there is not an intention to turn over the markets. The intention is really to follow the rules that have been established more informally over the last 10 years or so, that these investors have been very heavy in private credit. But we'll need to see what comments go in on the proposed regulations and where we end up in any final regulations.
Thanks, Kirsten. So what specific rules in the proposed regulation are giving people pause in this area?
So aside from those two safe harbors, the regulations include a list of different factors that could be considered in a facts and circumstances analysis of whether a credit investment is commercial activity or isn't commercial activity. And they also include a number of different examples that the government thought would be helpful to share some fact patterns on. This is something that we view as commercial activity. This other fact pattern we view as not commercial activity. So on the not commercial activity fact pattern, there's an example of what's really a shareholder loan. And they say, if you're heavily invested in the equity of the company and you're making a shareholder loan to them, we are not concerned about that being commercial activity. The ones people are more concerned about are two other examples. In one example, you have a Section 892 investor that is soliciting an investment, so that it's not uncommon in the market for these investors. While they're typically more passive, they do go out and solicit some investments. And this 892 investor has solicited a single credit investment over its lifespan, and that single credit investment is determined to be commercial activity. That is not how people thought the market worked. Another example, I think, is probably even more egregious. So in this example, the 892 investor has made a secondary acquisition of credit, and there's no problem with that initial acquisition of credit. At the time when they made the investment, they expected the credit to perform, so there was no anticipation of a workout. But something happens with the business, it's going into workout. Because the 892 investor decides to take a seat on the creditors committee to protect their rights as an investor in this company that they were never expecting to go into workout, the example concludes that just the mere fact of taking that seat on the creditors committee turns that loan into commercial activity when they take the reissued loan. And really, an 892 investor should be able to have the same economic rights as any other investor to protect their investment. And so that is not something that people thought could even possibly be treated as commercial activity.
That's really helpful, Kirsten. So mostly we've been talking about investments and investment funds and asset managers, but you know, what are the 892 implications for corporations? Why should a strategic corporate care about 892?
So in the past, sovereign wealth funds often invested across public equities, and they would just ensure that they took less than 5% of all the companies to avoid public disclosure. But over time, the sovereign investors have really started stepping out of the shadows, and they are more willing to publicly share where they invest and to invest larger shares in corporations. Many of them have shifted to a more direct investment mandate, so they're independently evaluating opportunities with their own in-house investment staff, and they're making some of their investments without partnering with a GP or a traditional asset manager. And for a corporation that's seeking long-term capital that's relatively passive, sovereign investment could be a really good way for them to grow their business. If the sovereign is just investing in corporate shares and they're only receiving dividends, Section 892 consideration should be very easy for that corporation to manage. So they should not be worried about trying to attract that kind of capital. But for a corporation that's willing to take the time to understand Section 892, understand what sorts of activities could implicate the protections, where they might not need the protections, and they could still invest and benefit from a different tax exemption, a unique structure could be used, something like a JV together with an 892 investor, a large equity investment, maybe project financing for different deals that they're working on. And that could really facilitate a large investment and a major expansion of the business. Since many sovereigns do prefer to use their internal resources on deals where they can commit a huge amount of capital with a single check, there could be a great strategic opportunity for corporations that are willing to work with them.
That's helpful, Kirsten. So I personally have learned a ton from preparing for this episode and recording, and I've increased my knowledge infinitely of 892 because it's gone from zero to a number. Kirsten, Dan, do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
892 investors, as the government expected, in general, are very happy to have some certainty. So we really, as a community, have been waiting for these regulations for a long time, and it's nice that there's finality, and it's nice that we can know how we can invest, where that could create issues, where it might not create issues. I think 892 investors are also really happy to hear the Treasury Secretary say, hey, where we got things wrong, that wasn't really our intent. And so please let us know how the market works, and we're willing to work with you to make sure that that's what we're reflecting in the rules.
That dialogue between investors and managers that take that you deploy capital from Section 892 investors and the government's going to be very important as these regulations move forward to finalization. We also have to keep in mind the length of time between the last proposed regulations and these final regulations. It's possible that investors are going to have the proposed regulations on effective control and loans outstanding for some time before they're further revised, because Treasury has a lot of other priorities, in particular with OB3 just having passed. So the market is going to have to see how it's going to take these regulations into account while they're in proposed form, notwithstanding the sympathetic comments they got from the Treasury Secretary.
One more final thought. So by their terms, the proposed regulations only apply to Section 892 and they only apply to commercial activity. And so they shouldn't have any impact outside of this class of investors we've been discussing. But that's not what we're seeing in the market. So we are seeing people come to us with questions and saying, you thought that the 892 rules work this way. It seems that Treasury has a different view. What does that mean for ECI? And what does that mean for other credit investors? For an investor that's made a single origination, could that cause them to have a U.S. trader business? Do I now need to worry about my investors who are trying to take a position that they're not engaged in a U.S. trader business, but want a creditor committee spot? And that's something that I think a lot of attention will also be paid to, and see if that changes the market.
So thank you, Dan and Kirsten, for your insights into sovereign wealth funds in Section 892. And a special thank you to Casey Caldwell for her help behind the scenes with this episode. We'll continue to monitor the impact of Section 892 on sovereign wealth funds and U.S. corporations. As always, please stay tuned for future episodes of KPMG's Inside International Tax to stay up to speed on the latest developments in U.S. international tax. Until our next episode, take care.